He managed to reach a point parallel with the top of the icicles before the conditions became impossible and he could go no higher. He was 20 feet above me, and for a while it seemed as if he was stuck. Reversing what he had just climbed would be to invite a nasty fall. Eventually, he succeeded in fixing a sling around a thick icicle which had rejoined the cascade to form a loop, and he abseiled off this down to my stance. "I'm knackered. You have a go." "Okay, but I'd move further to the side if I were you. I'll have to knock most of those icicles away." Many of them were as thick as a man's arm and nearly 5 feet long. Some even bigger. I started up the ice wall, which pushed me back off balance, and at once I felt the strain on my arms. The sack on my back pulled me away from the ice. I bunny-hopped my crampons quickly up the wall, smashing my axes hard into the brittle ice above, pulling up, hopping again, all the time trying to save my strength by climbing fast. As I neared the icicles, I realized that I would be unable to hold on for very much longer. Already I was too tired to break away the icicles while holding on to the wall with one axe. I swung as hard as I could until my axe bit in deeply and was firm enough to hold me. I then clipped my harness into the wrist loop on the axe and hung wearily from it. I kept a wary eye on the axe tip embedded in the ice, and only when I was sure it was holding my full weight safely did I extract my hammer axe from the wall and, reaching above me, hammer an ice screw into the wall. I clipped the rope through the screw and breathed a sigh of relief. At least there was no longer a danger of falling more than 5 or 6 feet. The icicles were within easy reach. Without thinking, I swung my hammer through the fringe of ice and, even more stupidly, looked up at what I was doing. The best part of 100 weight of icicles smashed down onto my head and shoulders and clattered away down onto Simon. We both started swearing. I cursed myself in the sharp pain of a split lip and cracked tooth, and Simon cursed me.
"Sorry, didn't think."
"Yeah, I noticed."
When I looked up again, I saw that although it was painful, the hammer had done the trick, and there was now a clear way through to the easier angled ice above. It didn't take long to swarm up the top of the wall and run the remainder of the rope to a belay in the wide shallow gully above. Simon came up covered in ice particles and frosted white by the powder snow which had swept down the cascade. He carried on past me to a slight ridge which marked the end of the ramp and the start of the summit slopes. He had lit the gas stove and cleared a place to sit in comfort by the time I joined him.
"Your mouth is bleeding," he said flatly.
"It's nothing. It was my fault anyway."
It was noticeably colder now that we were away from the shelter of the ice gullies and exposed to a steady breeze. For the first time we could see the summit, formed from a huge overhanging cornice which bulged out over the slopes 800 feet above us. The ridge sweeping off to the left would be our line of descent, but we couldn't see it very well in the swirling clouds which were steadily spilling over from the east. It looked as if bad weather was on the way. Simon passed me a hot drink, and then huddled deeper into his jacket with his back to the bitter wind. He was looking at the summit slopes, searching for the best line of ascent. It was the state of the snow on this last part of the route that worried us more than the angle or the technical difficulties. The whole slope was corrugated by powder flutings, which had gradually built up as fresh snow had sloughed down the face. We had heard all about Peruvian flutings and hadn't liked the stories. It was best not to attempt them. The weather patterns in Europe never produced such horrors. South American mountains were renowned for these spectacular snow and ice creations, where powder snow seemed to defy gravity and form 70-degree, even 80-degree slopes, and ridges developed into tortured, unstable cornices of huge size, built up one on top of the other. On any other mountains, the powder snow would have swept on down, and only formed on much easier angled slopes. Above us, a rock band cut across the whole slope. It was not steep, but was powdered with a treacherous coating of snow. After 100 feet, it merged back into the snow slope, which grew steeper as it climbed up. The fluting started shortly above the rock band and continued without break to the summit. Once we had established ourselves in the gully formed between two flutings, we would have to force a way to the top, for it would be impossible to traverse out by crossing a fluting and getting into the neighbouring gully. It would be vitally important to choose the right gully, and we could see that many of them closed down into dead ends as two flutings merged together. If I looked carefully, I could make out a few gullies which did not close down, but as soon as I tried to look at the whole slope, these became lost in the maze of gullies and flutings streaming down the face.
"Christ, it looks desperate," Simon said. "I can't work out a way up at all."
"I can't see us getting to the top today."
"Not if those clouds unload, that's for sure. What time is it?"
4 o'clock. 2 hours light left. Better get moving. I wasted valuable time trying to cross the rock band. It was tilted like a steep roof, but unlike the rock in the ramp, it was black and compact with only a few small holds mostly hidden beneath the snow. I knew it wasn't difficult, but I was standing on an open face with a drop of nearly 4,000 feet below me and felt very unnerved by the exposure. There was also a long gap of unprotected rope between me and Simon, who was belaying me from our resting place. His only anchor was his axes buried in the snow, and I knew all too well how useless these would be if I made a mistake. My left foot slipped, and the crampon points skittered on the rock. I hated this sort of delicate balance climbing, but I was committed to it now, no going back. As I balanced on two small edges of rock, front points teetering on the verge of slipping, my legs began to tremble, and I shouted a warning to Simon. I could hear the fear in my voice and cursed myself for letting Simon know it. I tried moving up again, but my nerve failed me and I couldn't complete the move. I knew it would take just a couple of moves to reach easier ground, and tried convincing myself that if this wasn't so terrifyingly exposed, I would walk up it, hands in pockets. But I couldn't shake off the fear. I was gripped. Gradually, I calmed down and carefully thought out the few moves I needed to make. When I tried again, I was surprised at how easy it seemed. I was above the difficulty and climbing quickly up easy ground before I realized it. The belay was little better than Simon's, and I warned him of this before he started after me. The sudden fright still had me breathing hard, and it annoyed me to see Simon climb easily over the difficulties and know that I had lost control and let fear get the better of me. "God, I was gripped stupid on that," I said. I noticed. "Which gully should we go for?" I had looked for a likely one, but found it impossible to see, when close up to them, whether they closed off or not. "I don't know. That one's the widest. I'll have a look at that." Simon entered the gully and immediately began floundering in deep powder. The sides of the flutings rose up 15 feet on either side of him. There was no chance of changing line. Spindrift avalanches poured down onto his struggling figure, so that sometimes he disappeared from sight. The light was going rapidly, and I noticed that it had begun to snow, the spindrift getting heavier. I was directly beneath Simon, and after sitting still for 2 hours, I was chilled to the bone. Simon was excavating huge quantities of snow down onto me, and I could do nothing to avoid it. I switched my head torch on, and was surprised to see that it was 8 o'clock, 4 hours to climb 300 feet. I seriously doubted whether we would be able to get up these flutings. At last, a distant, muffled shout from the snow-filled clouds told me to follow on. I was dangerously cold, despite having put on my polar jacket and windproof. We would have to bivouac somewhere on these horrendous slopes, because sitting still for such a long time while belaying was out of the question. I couldn't believe what Simon had done to climb that rope length up the gully. He had dug a trench 4 feet deep by 4 feet wide all the way up it. His exhausting search for more solid snow yielding a weak layer of crusted ice which barely held his weight. Most of this had been broken away as he had climbed, so that I had great difficulty following his lead. It had taken him 3 hours to climb, and when I reached him, I could see that it had tired him out. I felt very tired, too, and cold, and it was important we bivouacked soon. "I can't believe this snow. Bloody terrifying. I thought I was falling off all the way up. We have to bivvy. I was freezing down there." "Yeah, but not here. The fluting has got too small." "Okay. You may as well lead up again." I knew it would be easier and avoid rope tangles, but I regretted not being able to keep moving. 2 freezing and interminable hours later, I joined Simon 100 feet higher up. He was belayed in a large hole he had dug into the base of the gully. "I've found some ice." "Good enough for an ice screw?" "Well, it's better than nothing. If you get in here, we can enlarge this sideways." I squeezed in beside him, fully expecting the floor of the cave to collapse down the gully at any moment. We began digging into the sides of the flutings, slowly enlarging the cave into a long rectangular snow hole set across the gully, with the entrance partially filled up by our excavations. By 11 o'clock we had settled into our sleeping bags, eaten the last freeze-dried meal, and were savouring a last hot drink of the day. 300 feet to go. I just hope it isn't worse than what we'd just done. At least the storm has stopped, but it's damn cold. I think my little finger is frostbitten. It's white down to the hand. It must have been close to -20 when we had been exposed to the spindrift in the gullies, and the wind had brought the wind chill temperature down nearer to -40. We were lucky to have found a place for a snow hole. I hoped we would have clear, sunny weather tomorrow. The base of the gas canister was coated in a thick layer of ice. I knocked it against my helmet and managed to remove most of it. Then I stuffed it deep into my sleeping bag, feeling the icy metal against my thighs. 5 minutes later, I was snuggled in again, with only my nose sticking out of the bag, and one eye keeping a sleepy watch on the stove. It roared busily, but it was dangerously close to my bag. Blue light shone through the cave walls. It had been a long and bitterly cold night at 20,000 feet, perhaps nearer 21,000. When the water was boiling, I sat up and hurriedly donned my polar jacket, windproof and gloves. I fumbled in the snow wall of the cave, looking for the sachet of fruit juice and the chocolate. "Brew's ready." "God's teeth, I'm bloody freezing." Simon uncurled from his cramped fetal position, took the steaming mug, and disappeared back into his bag. I drank slowly, hugging the hot cup to my chest, watching the second lot of snow melt down in the pan. The gas flame was not so strong.
"How much gas have we got left?" I asked.
"One tin. Is that one empty?"
"Not quite. We may as well drink as much as it'll produce and save the other for the descent."
"Yeah. We haven't got much fruit juice left either. Just one packet."
"We'll have judged it right, then. Enough for one more bivvy. That's all we need."
It was a long, cold business gearing up, but that was the least of my worries. The flutings lay ahead, and it was my turn to lead. To make things more difficult, I had to exit the cave and somehow climb over the roof, which stretched the full width of the gully. I succeeded, but not without destroying most of the cave and burying Simon, who had belayed me from inside. Once onto the slope of the gully, I looked back down to where we had climbed the previous night. All traces of the trench dug by Simon had disappeared. It had been swept clean and refilled by the incessant waves of spindrift which had poured down the gully during the snowstorm. I was disappointed to see that the gully ended about 100 feet above me. The flutings on each side joined together to form a single razor-sharp ribbon of powder. I would have to try to cross over into another fluting after all. The sky was clear, and there was no wind. It was Simon's turn to sit stoically under the deluge of snow I was forced to kick down, but daylight had dubious advantages. It made the climbing easier and allowed me to see whether I was about to slip. On the other hand, it provided unnerving glimpses between my legs of 4,500 feet of emptiness. Knowing that our belays were anything but secure, and that any fall would be disastrous, made me concentrate on the way ahead. As I approached the dead end in the gully, the angle steadily increased, and it became obvious that I would have to traverse out through the side fluting soon. But which one? I couldn't see over the sides of the flutings and had no idea what I would be traversing into. I looked down and saw Simon watching me intently. Only his head and chest stuck out from the roof of the cave, and the huge drop framed behind him emphasized the precariousness of our position. I could see that the flutings were not as high near the cave, and that Simon might be able to see more of the way ahead than I could.
"Which way should I go? Can you see anything?"
"Don't go left."
"Why?"
"Seems to drop away, and looks bloody dangerous."
"What's on the right?"
"Can't see, but the flutings are not so steep. It's a lot better than the left, anyway." I hesitated. Once I started ploughing through a fluting, I might be unable to return. I didn't want to find myself in an even worse position. However high I stretched, I couldn't see into the gully on my right. I wasn't even sure there would be a gully there, and none of the snow I could see above me gave any idea of what might be awaiting me.
"Okay, watch the ropes,"
I shouted as I began to dig into the right-hand side of the gully. Then I laughed at what I'd just said. It would do no good concentrating on belaying if the belay was going to rip straight out. To my surprise, digging furiously with both axes into the fluting was no harder than climbing the gully, and I emerged, breathing hard, on the other side, in an identical steepening gully above which I could see the huge cornice of the summit only a rope's length away. Simon floundered up to me and whooped when he saw the summit behind me.
"Cracked it," he said.
"I hope so, but this last bit looks bloody steep."
"It'll go."
He set off up the slope, churning huge amounts of freezing snow down onto my exposed belay hole. I pulled my hood over my helmet and turned my back, gazing down at the glacier far below me. Suddenly, our exposed stance appalled me. The loose snow was so steep, and my belay so precarious, that I felt a sickening disbelief in what we were doing. An excited yell tore me from my thoughts, and I turned to see the rope disappearing over the top of the gully above.
"Done it! No more flutings! Come up!"
He was sitting, legs astride a fluting, grinning manically when I pulled myself wearily out of the gully. Behind him, less than 50 feet from us, the summit cornice reared up in a threatening bulge of snow ice which overhung the west face. I quickly moved past Simon and cramponed on firm snow up and to the left where the summit cornice was smallest. 10 minutes later, I stood beneath the snow ridge dividing west face from east. "Take a photo!" I waited until Simon had his camera ready before planting my axe over the ridge onto the east side and heaving myself over onto the broad-backed col under the summit. For the first time in 4 days, I had a new view on which to feast. The sun bathed the snow, sweeping down into the eastern glacier. After the long, cold, shadowed days on the west face, it felt luxurious to sit there warmed by the sun. I had forgotten that now we were climbing in the southern hemisphere, everything was the wrong way round. South faces here were the equivalent of icy cold north faces in the Alps, and east faces became west. No wonder the mornings had been so cold and shadowed, and we had to wait until late in the day before being blessed with a few hours' sunshine. Simon joined me, and we laughed happily as we took off our sacks and sat on them, carelessly dropping axes and mitts in the snow, content to be quiet a while and look around us. "Let's leave the sacks here and go up to the summit," Simon said, interrupting my self-indulgent reverie. "The summit, of course. I'd forgotten we had only reached the ridge. Escaping from the west face had seemed to be an end in itself. I looked up at the ice cream cone rising behind Simon. It was only about 100 feet away. "You go ahead. I'll take some photos when you reach the top." He grabbed some chocolate and sweets before getting up and tramping slowly up through soft snow. The altitude was having its effect. When he was outlined against the sky, bending over his axe on top of the spectacular summit cornice, I began feverishly snapping photographs. Leaving the sacks at the col, I followed, breathing hard and feeling the tiredness in my legs. We took the customary summit photos and ate some chocolate. I felt the usual anticlimax. What now? It was a vicious circle. If you succeed with one dream, you come back to square one, and it's not long before you're conjuring up another, slightly harder, a bit more ambitious, a bit more dangerous. I didn't like the thought of where it might be leading me. As if, in some strange way, the very nature of the game was controlling me, taking me towards a logical but frightening conclusion. It always unsettled me, this moment of reaching the summit, this sudden stillness and quiet after the storm, which gave me time to wonder at what I was doing, and sense a niggling doubt that perhaps I was inexorably losing control. Was I here purely for pleasure, or was it egotism? Did I really want to come back for more? But these moments were also good times, and I knew that the feelings would pass. Then I could excuse them as morbid, pessimistic fears that had no sound basis. "Looks like we're in for another storm," Simon said. He had been quietly examining the North Ridge, our line of descent, which was rapidly being obscured by massed clouds rolling up the east face and tumbling out over onto the west side. Even now I could see little of the ridge, and the glacier up which we had made our approach would be completely covered within the hour. The ridge began where we had left our sacks and rose to a subsidiary summit before twisting back on itself and curling down into the clouds. I saw snatches of frighteningly steep razor edges through cloud gaps and some dangerously corniced sections, the east face dropping away to the right in a continuous flank of tortured flutings. We would be unable to traverse below the corniced ridge at a safe distance. The flutings looked impassable. "Jesus, it looks hairy. Yeah, better get our skates on. If we move quickly, we can traverse under that summit and then rejoin the ridge further down. In fact, I don't think we'll even have an hour." Simon held out his hand, and the first snowflakes drifted down lazily onto his glove. We returned to the sacks, and then set off to circle around the minor summit. Simon led the way. We moved, roped together, with coils of rope in hand in case of a fall. It was the fastest way, and, with the deep powder snow hampering our progress, it was our only chance of getting past the minor summit in reasonable visibility. If Simon fell, I hoped to have time enough to get my axe buried, though I doubted whether the axe would find any purchase in the loose snow. The clouds closed in on us after half an hour, when we were on the east flank of the second summit. 10 minutes later we were lost in the whiteout. There was no wind, and the snow fell silently in large, heavy flakes. It was about 2:30, and we knew it would snow until late evening. We stood in silence, staring around us, trying to make out where we were. "I think we should head down." "I don't know. No, not down. We must keep in touch with the ridge. Didn't you see those flutings on this side? We'd never get back up again." "Have we got past that second summit?"
"I think so, yes."
"I can't see anything up there."
The snow and cloud merged into a uniform blank whiteness. I could see no difference between snow and sky further than 5 feet from me.
"Wish we had a compass."
As I spoke, I noticed a lightening in the cloud above us.
The sun, shining weakly through the murk, cast the faintest of shadows on the ridge 100 feet above us, but before I had a chance to tell Simon, it was gone.
I've just seen the ridge.
Where?
Straight above us. Can't see a thing now, but I definitely saw it.
Right, I'll climb up and find it. If you stay here, you'll have better luck stopping me if I don't see the edge of the ridge in time. He set off, and after a short time I had only the ropes moving through my hands to show me he was there. The snowfall was getting heavier. I felt the first twinges of anxiety. This ridge had turned out to be a lot more serious than we ever imagined while our attention had been focused on the route up the west face. I was about to call out to Simon and ask if he could see anything, but the words died on my lips as the ropes suddenly whipped out through my gloves. At the same time, a deep, heavy explosion of sound echoed through the clouds. The ropes ran unchecked through my wet, icy gloves for a few feet, then tugged sharply at my harness, pulling me chest first into the snow slope. The roaring died away. I knew at once what had happened. Simon must have fallen through the corniced ridge, yet the volume of sound suggested something more like a Serac avalanche. I waited. The ropes remained taut with his body weight.
"Simon!" I yelled. "You okay?"
There was no answer. I decided to wait before attempting to move up towards the ridge. If he was hanging over the west side, I reckoned it would be some time before he sorted himself out and managed to regain the ridge. After about 15 minutes, I heard Simon shouting unintelligibly. The weight had come off the rope, and I climbed towards him until I could make out what he was saying.
"I found the ridge!"
I had gathered that and laughed nervously. He had indeed found a lot more of the ridge than he had bargained for. I stopped grinning when I reached him. He was standing shakily just below the crest. "I thought I'd had it there," he muttered, suddenly sitting down heavily in the snow, as if his legs had failed him. "Bloody hell. That was it. The whole bloody thing fell off. God." He shook his head as if trying to dislodge what he'd just seen. When the fright eased and his body stopped pumping adrenaline, he looked back at the edge of the ridge and quietly told me what had happened. I never saw the ridge. I just glimpsed an edge of it far away to the left. There was no warning, no crack. One minute I was climbing, the next I was falling. It must have broken away 40 feet back from the edge. It broke behind me, I think, or under my feet. Either way, it took me down instantly. It was so fast. I had no time to think. I didn't know what the hell was going on, except that I was falling. I'll bet. I looked at the drop of the face behind him as he bowed his head and breathed hard, one hand on his thigh, trying to stop the telltale tremor in his leg. I was tumbling all over the place, and everything seemed to be happening in slow motion. I forgot I was tied to the rope. The noise and the falling, it just stopped me understanding anything. I can remember seeing all these huge blocks of snow falling with me. They fell at the same speed at first, and I thought, this is it. They were massive. 10, 20-foot square chunks. He was calmer now, but I shivered at the thought of what would have happened if I had moved up with him. It would have taken both of us. Then I felt the rope at my waist, but I thought it would just come down with me. I wasn't stopping, and all the blocks were smashing against me, flipping me over. He paused again, then continued. It was much lighter below me, and the blocks tumbled away from me down an enormous drop of space, spinning and breaking up. I kept getting glimpses of this as the snow walloped into me and spun me around. Perhaps I wasn't falling by then, but all the thumping and spinning made it feel as if I was. It seemed to be going on and on and on. I wasn't scared then, just totally confused and numb, as if real time was standing still and there was no longer time to be frightened. When he did finally stop, he was hanging in space, and could see over to his left the ridge still peeling away. The cloud on the east side blocked the view slightly, but great blocks of snow were falling from the cloud and went crashing down the face below, as if the ridge was breaking away from him. At first I was so disoriented I wasn't sure whether I was safe or not. I had to think it out before I realized that you had held my fall. The drop below me was horrific. I could see right down the west face, 4,500 feet, clear all the way to the glacier. I was in panic for a while. The huge drop had appeared so suddenly beneath me, and I was hanging 30 feet below the ridgeline, not touching the slope. The head wall of the west face was directly beneath me. I could see our route up the ice field. "If that cornice had come down, we would have just disappeared without trace," I ventured. "How did you get back?" "Well, I tried to get back onto the ridge, and it turned out to be one hell of a struggle. The brake line left by the cornice was vertical snow and nearly 30 feet high. I didn't know if what was left after the collapse was safe. When I finally got up, I heard you shouting from down on the east face, and I was nearly too tired to answer. I still couldn't see an end to the fresh brake line on the ridge. It seemed close to 200 feet. Funny how the visibility cleared as soon as I fell. 5 minutes later, and I would have seen the danger.
We were now faced with a very dangerous ridge, which, although it had collapsed, was no safer as a result. We could see secondary fracture lines in the snow just back from the edge, and one particular fracture ran parallel to and only 4 feet away from the crest for as far as we could see.
4. On the edge. There was no question of traversing lower down on the east face, for this was a continuous series of large flutings running down into the clouds, which had closed over the void again several hundred feet below us. It had stopped snowing. The flutings would be impossibly slow and dangerous to climb across, and to descend lower would see us lost in the whiteout conditions below the cloud. There were few choices left open to us. Simon stood up and began moving gingerly along the crest 5 feet from the edge, along the continual crack line running away from us. I moved further down the east face to wait until he had taken out all the slack rope. At least then I could stop him if the ridge broke away again, but eventually I would have to join him, and we would move together along the ridge. As I climbed up to rejoin his tracks, it occurred to me that I had felt a moment of anxiety only minutes before Simon had fallen. I had noticed this in the past, and always wondered about it. There had been no good reason for the sudden stab of worry. We had been on the mountain for over 50 hours, and perhaps had become attuned to potential threats, so much so that I had sensed something would happen without understanding quite what it would be. I didn't like this irrational theory, since anxiety had returned with a vengeance. I could see that Simon had also tensed up. The descent was already far more serious than we had reckoned. I moved carefully. I watched the crack line, checked I had put my feet exactly where Simon's footsteps were, and continued nervously 150 feet behind Simon, who had his back to me. I might have a chance if I saw him fall in time. I could throw myself down the opposite side of the ridge and expect the ropes to stop us as they soared through the ridge. He would have little or no warning. He might hear me scream out or hear the ridge break, but he would have to turn round to see which side I was falling down before he could jump to the safe side. It seemed to me that the most likely accident would involve the whole ridge collapsing, taking us both down in one very long breakaway of snow. I saw the crack close up, and when I moved past it, I breathed a sigh of relief. The ridge was slightly safer at last. Unfortunately, it now dropped away steeply and twisted back on itself with each turn, huge cornices bulging out over the west face. I saw that these difficulties eased further in the distance, so I wasn't surprised when Simon began descending the east face. He intended to lose enough height to be able to traverse directly across to the easier section and avoid descending the tortured ridge. The easier ground lay a couple of 100 feet below our point on the ridge. I guessed how far we needed to descend before following Simon down. We hadn't descended far before I realized how poor the light had become. I checked my watch and was surprised to see that it had gone 5 o'clock. We had left the summit nearly 3.5 hours earlier, and yet had made little progress along the ridge. It would be dark in an hour, and to make things more difficult, the storm clouds had boiled over us again, and snowflakes were blowing up from the east into our faces. The temperature had also dropped sharply, and with the wind building up, it felt icy cold whenever we stopped. Simon descended a gully between 2 flutings. I followed slowly, trying to keep the distance between us by moving only when the ropes moved. I descended into a uniform whiteness, snow and cloud merging into one. After a while, I decided that we must have reached a point where we could now traverse horizontally across to the easier ground, but Simon carried on down. I shouted for him to stop, but received only a muffled reply. I yelled louder, and the rope stopped moving through my gloves. Neither of us could understand the other's shouts, so I moved down to get within earshot. I was alarmed to find that the gully became steeper, and I kept slipping. I turned round to face into the slope, but it was still hard to remain in control. I was close to him when I heard Simon shout again and could hear his query about why we had stopped. At that moment, the snow whooshed away from under my feet and I dropped swiftly. I had both axes dug deep into the gully, but they didn't stop me. I screamed a warning and suddenly bumped heavily against Simon, stopping jammed up against him. "Jesus! Oh, shit, I thought we'd had it. This is fucking stupid." Simon said nothing. I leant face first into the gully and tried to calm down. My heart seemed to be trying to hammer its way out of my chest, and my legs shook weakly. It had been fortunate that I was so close to Simon when I fell, not too far above, to have built up enough speed to knock him down.
You okay? Simon asked.
Yes, scared. That's all.
Yeah.
We've gone far too low.
Oh, I was thinking perhaps we could descend all the way into the Eastern Glacier Bay.
You're joking. Bloody hell, I've just nearly killed both of us on this bit, and we haven't a clue what it's like below us.
But that ridge is crazy. We'll never get down it tonight. We're not getting off this tonight anyway. For God's sake, it's almost dark now. If we rush off down there, we'll be lucky if we ever get off this bloody thing.
Okay. Okay, calm down. It's just an idea.
Sorry. I was freaked out.
Couldn't we traverse out sideways from here and get back to the ridge where it drops down?
Okay. You first.
I sorted out the tangles from my fall and then began digging into the right side of the fluting. An hour and a half later, I had managed to cross innumerable flutings and gullies, and Simon was following a rope's length behind me. We had covered less than 200 feet, and by then it was snowing hard, bitterly cold and windy. It was also dark, and we were having to use our head torches. Stumbling through a wall of sugary snow and into another gully, I kicked against rock beneath the snow.
"Simon!" I shouted. "Stop where you are a while. There's a small rock wall here. It's a bit tricky getting round it."
I decided to place a rock peg in the wall, and then tentatively balance round the obstacle. I succeeded with the rock peg, but somehow managed to fall down and round the wall without coming onto the rope. Simon employed an equally basic climbing technique using gravity and body weight, jumping down the wall without being able to see where he would land, but correct in the assumption that, when he did, it would be with such force that he would safely bury himself firmly in the loose snow beyond. The only flaw I could find in his reasoning was that he didn't know whether his landing would be loose snow or rock. We were too tired and cold by then to care. Once beyond the rock, we crossed an open slope of powder, mercifully, without flutings. We were heading back up towards where we guessed the ridge would be, and after a couple of rope lengths found a large cone of snow swept up against a rock wall. We decided to dig a snow cave. Simon's head torch kept flickering from a loose or damaged connection. I began digging and soon struck rock. I tried digging parallel with the rock to make a long, narrow cave, but after half an hour gave up. The cave had so many holes in it that it would provide little protection from the wind. It was bitterly cold, and Simon had struggled to repair his head torch with his bare fingers, fiddling with the copper contacts in the dark. Digging had kept me warm, despite the temperature falling to around the -20 mark, but two of Simon's fingers were frostbitten. He became angry with me when I started to dig another cave. Unjustly, I decided that Simon was behaving petulantly and ignored him. The next site for the cave was marginally better, and although I struck rock, I managed to build it to fit the two of us. By then, Simon had mended the torch, but his fingers were beyond rewarming. He was still bristling with anger at my lack of cooperation. I prepared the meal. There was little enough left. We ate chocolate and dried fruit, and drank a lot of fruit juice. By then we had forgotten our tired anger and regained a sense of perspective. I had been as cold and tired as Simon, and had only wanted a cave dug quickly so that we could get into our sleeping bags and make some hot drinks. It had been another very long day. It had started well, and we had been glad to get off the west face, but the descent had become increasingly difficult and nerve-wracking. Falling over the cornice had shaken both of us, and the strain afterwards had been wearing. We had got angry enough with each other today, and more of the same wouldn't help. Simon showed me his fingers, which had slowly come back to life, but the index finger on each hand remained white and solid as far back as the first knuckle. So, he had frostbite. I hoped it would not suffer further damage the next day. However, I felt sure that we were close to the end of the difficulties on the ridge, and that we would be able to reach base camp by the following afternoon. We only had enough gas left for 2 drinks in the morning, but that should be enough. As I settled myself down for sleep, I couldn't shake off the dread feelings I had experienced while traversing the ridge. The image of the two of us falling helplessly down the east face, still roped together, had all too nearly come true. I shuddered at the prospect of such an end. I knew Simon must have felt the same. The year before, he had witnessed just such a terrible accident at the Cross Spur, high in the Mont Blanc range of the French Alps. 2 Japanese climbers had fallen to their deaths from close to where he stood, only a short distance from the top of the route. For 3 days, stormy weather had produced atrocious conditions. The rocks were plastered in verglas, a hard patina of ice covering the holds and filling the cracks. Progress had been painfully slow, as each hold was chipped clear, and otherwise easy sections had become desperately extreme climbing.
Simon and his partner, John Sylvester, had bivouacked twice on the face, and late in the afternoon of that third day, another storm was building up. The temperature plummeting, heavy clouds shrouding them in a world of their own, and the first spindrift powder snow avalanches sweeping down. The two Japanese climbers had been following them closely. They had bivouacked separately, and there was no communication between the two teams. Nor was there any sense of competitiveness or a suggestion that they might join forces. Both parties were coping equally well in the difficult conditions. There were frequent falls, often from the same points. They had watched one another struggle, fall, and try again as they progressed up the face. When they reached the summit headwall, Simon had seen the leading Japanese climber fall outwards and backwards, arms outstretched in surprise. The awesome 2,500-foot plunge, visible through breaks in the cloud, was framed behind him. To his horror, he had then seen the falling leader jerk and twist and, without a sound, pull his partner into the void. Their belay piton had torn free. The two men plunged down, roped together, helpless. Simon had struggled up to John's stance, which was out of sight of that lower section, and told him what had happened. They stood quietly on the small rock ledge in the gathering storm, trying to absorb the enormity of what had just taken place so close to them. There was nothing they could do for the two men, who would never have survived the fall, and the quickest way to get news to the rescue services would be over the summit and down into Italy. As they resumed the climb, they were shocked to hear a ghastly screaming from far below, the chilling sounds of someone in agony, desperately alone and terrified. Looking down, they saw the two climbers sliding down the upper ice field at ever-increasing speed 600 feet below them. They were still roped together, and various scattered items of gear and their rucksacks tumbled alongside them. All Simon could do was to stare helplessly at the two tiny figures racing down the ice. Then they were gone, disappearing over the lip of the ice field, falling out of view into the horrendous drop to the glacier. By some desperate quirk, at least one of the climbers must have survived the initial fall onto the ice field. Somehow they had been stopped, probably with their rope snagged on some rocky projection, but they weren't saved. It was a cruel twist, both for the victims and for the horrified spectators far above them. Only a short reprieve, 5 minutes or so, while one of them fought to make himself safe and find some anchor. Badly injured, he had had little chance. Perhaps he had slipped, or the rope had unsnagged. Whatever had happened, the outcome was brutally final. Simon and John, their confidence shattered, minds numbed by it all, had turned and struggled on up to the summit. It had been so sudden. They hadn't conversed with the two Japanese, but a mutual understanding and respect had developed. If they had all got down safely, then they would have talked, shared food on the long walk to the valley, met up in a bar in town, perhaps become friends. I could remember seeing Simon walking slowly into the campsite outside Chamonix when he got back. He was subdued and looked drawn and tired. He had sat numb, repeatedly questioning why his own tumble had been held on the same piton just before the Japanese leader had fallen and ripped it out. A day later, he was his normal self again, an experience absorbed, shelved in his memory, understood and accepted, and left at that. As sleep crept swiftly through me, I tried to shake off the thought of how close we had come to the same appalling end as those two Japanese. There would have been no one to watch us, I thought, as if it would have made any difference. I had the stove burning away cheerfully by my side and could look beyond it through a hole in the snow cave. The east face of Yerapaha was framed perfectly in the circular window I had accidentally built into the cave. The early morning sun etched the ridge lines with shadows and danced blue shadings down the edges of the flutings on the face. For the first time in the last 4 days, the tense concentration in my body relaxed. The anxious struggles of the previous night had been forgotten, and the memory of how close we had come to falling to our deaths had faded. I gave myself time to enjoy where I was, and to congratulate myself. I craved a cigarette. It was cramped in the snow hole, but infinitely warmer than in the previous one. Simon was still asleep, lying on his side close by me, facing away. His hips and shoulders pressed up against my side, and I could feel his body warmth seeping through my sleeping bag. The close intimacy seemed odd, despite how together we had been on the mountain. I moved carefully to avoid waking him. I looked through the round hole window at the east face and felt myself smiling. I knew it would be a good day. The gas was all used up in the breakfast routine, and there would be no more water until we got down to the lakes below the moraines. I dressed and geared up first, before climbing out of the cave and going over to the first cave I had attempted to dig. Simon was slow getting ready, and it wasn't until he joined me on the large platform of the collapsed cave that I remembered his frostbite. My good humour vanished to be replaced by worry when he showed his fingers to me. One fingertip was blackened, and three other fingers were white and wooden in appearance. Funny how my anxiety seemed to have more to do with whether he would be able to carry on climbing after we got down, rather than concern for his injuries. I started up towards the crest of the ridge, which was bathed in sunshine, half a rope's length above me, while Simon remained below guarding the ropes. We were both nervous about the possibility of another cornice collapse. When I reached the ridge, I was dismayed to see that there was a long section of tortured cornices and knife-edge powder to negotiate. My hope that we might have bypassed it all the day before evaporated. I shouted a warning down to Simon, and he agreed to follow me, moving together once all the rope had run out. Though we moved with exaggerated caution, we couldn't avoid slipping and falling, only half in control, down the worst sections. I stayed close to the top of the ridge, which kept curling back on itself and dropping suddenly in short, steep walls. The possibility of a cornice collapse gradually faded from my mind as I moved, and I became resigned to the helplessness of our situation. The flutings lower down the east face would almost certainly be a worse proposition. As great a danger as the cornices was the risk of a fall. Any fall requiring a rope to stop it was going to be fatal. Neither of us would stand a chance, yet every time I approached a steep section and was forced to backclimb facing into the snow, I usually did so by a combination of falling and climbing. The powder was so insubstantial that however hard I kicked my legs, I would whoosh down a few feet as soon as I got my weight off my arms. Each sudden, heart-stopping slide seemed somehow to halt of its own accord. Where I would stop would be no more solid than where I had fallen from. It wore one's nerves ragged. I slipped again, but this time yelped out in fright. The short, steep slope I was descending bottomed directly onto the edge of the ridge, which had curved back on itself. I had seen as I turned to face into the slope that a huge powdery cornice bulged out beneath this curve, and falling away below it, the west face plunged thousands of feet down to the glacier. Simon, moving a full rope's length behind me, was out of sight, and would have no warning, no idea which side I was falling down. I rushed down in a flurry of powder so fast that my yelp came out more as a squeak of alarm than an attempted warning cry. Simon didn't see the fall and heard nothing. Then, just as suddenly, I stopped, with my whole body pressed into the snow, head buried in it, with my arms and legs spread-eagled in a desperate, crabbed position. I dared not move. It seemed as if only luck was holding me onto the slope, and feeling the snow moving and sliding down past my stomach and thighs just made me cringe in deeper. I lifted my head and glanced sideways over my right shoulder. I was on the very edge of the ridge, exactly at the point of the curve. My body was tipped over to the right so that I seemed to be hanging out over the west face. All my thoughts became locked into not moving. I gasped fast breaths, scared sucks at the air, but I didn't move. When I looked again, I realized that I wasn't actually off balance, although the brief glance before had made me think I was. It was like discovering the trick behind an optical illusion, suddenly seeing what you had really been staring at all the time. The curve of the ridge away back to my left, and the glimpse of the bulging cornice under its arc had confused me so much that I had thought I was leaning over the fall line. In fact, I found that my right leg had punctured straight through the cornice and, though my other leg had stopped me, it had also pushed me over sideways. This explained why I felt unbalanced, right side down. I scrabbled and clawed at the snow on my left, trying to pull my weight over to that side, trying to get my right leg back onto the ridge. Eventually I succeeded and moved away from the edge, following the curve of the ridge again. Simon appeared above me, moving slowly, looking down at his feet all the time. I had moved to a safer place and shouted a warning for him to descend the slope further to the left, and realized as I did so that I was shaking violently. My legs had gone to sudden jelly, quivering, and it took a long while for the reaction to fade. Long enough for me to watch Simon face into the slope and descend it in two footsteps and the inevitable rushing slide. When he turned and followed my steps, I could see the tension in his face. The day was neither enjoyable nor funny, and when he reached me the fear was infectious. We chattered out our alarm in quavery voices, quick staccato curses and repeated phrases tumbling out before we calmed.
5. Disaster. We had left the snow hole at 7:30, and 2.5 hours later I could see that our progress was painfully slow. Since leaving the summit the previous afternoon, we had descended no more than 1,000 feet instead of getting all the way down to the glacier in the 6 hours which we had reckoned. I began to feel impatient. I was tired of this grinding need to concentrate all the time. The mountain had lost its excitement, its novelty, and I wanted to get off it as soon as possible. The air was bitingly cold, and the sky cloudless. The sun burnt down in a dazzling glare on the endless snow and ice. As long as we were back on the glacier before the afternoon storms, I didn't care a damn what the weather chose to do. At last the twisting mayhem of the upper ridge eased, and I could walk upright across the broad level ridge which undulated away in whale-backed humps towards the drop at its northern end. Simon caught up with me as I rested on my sack. We didn't speak. The morning had already taken its toll, and there was nothing left to say. Looking up at our footsteps, weaving an unsteady path down towards us, I vowed silently to be more careful about checking descent routes in future. I shouldered my sack and set off again, with no qualms about being in front now. I had wanted Simon to lead on the last stretch, but had been unable to voice my apprehension and feared his response to it more than I feared another sickening fall. Deep snow had built up on the wide, level saddle, and instead of anxiety swamping my every move, I was back to the frustration of wallowing through powder snow. I had run out the rope, and Simon was getting up to follow when I stepped into the first crevasse. In a rushing drop, I suddenly found myself standing upright, but with my eyes level with the snow. The shallow fissure was filled with powder, so that however hard I thrashed about, I seemed to make no upward movement at all. Eventually, I managed to haul myself back onto level ground. From a safe distance, Simon had watched my struggles with a grin on his face. I moved farther along the ridge and sank down again, neck-deep in the snow. I yelled and cursed as I clawed my way back onto the ridge, and by the time I had traversed halfway across the plateau above it, I had fallen into another 4 small crevasses. However hard I tried, I could not see any telltale marks indicating their presence. Simon was following a full rope's length behind. Frustration and the mounting exhaustion maddened me to a fury which I knew would be vented on Simon if he came close enough. Then, crouching beside the hole I had just made, trying to regain my breath, I glanced back and was shocked to see clear through the ridge into the yawning abyss below. Blue-white light gleamed up through the hole from the expanse of the west face, which I could see looming beneath it. Suddenly it clicked in my brain why I had fallen through so many times. It was all one crevasse, one long fracture line cutting right through the enormous humping cornices that made up the plateau. I moved quickly away to the side and shouted a warning to Simon. The rolling ridge had been so wide and flat, it had never occurred to me that we might actually be standing on an overhanging cornice, one as large as the summit cornice, but stretching for several hundred feet. If it had collapsed, we would have gone with it. I kept well back from the edge after that, leaving a healthy margin of 50 feet. Simon had fallen with the smaller cornice collapse when he was 40 feet back from the edge. There was no point in taking chances now that the flutings on the east side had eased into a uniformly smooth slope. My legs felt leaden, trudging through the deep snow towards the end of the plateau. As I crested the last rise in the ridge and glanced back, I saw Simon hauling himself along in the same head-down, dog-tired manner as myself, a full rope's length from me, 150 feet away, and I knew he would be out of sight once I began descending the long, easy-angled slope ahead. I had hoped to see the slope run down to the col, but was disappointed to find it rising slightly to a minor summit of cornices before dropping steeply down again. Even so, I could see enough of the south ridge of Yerapaja to know that the col would certainly lie immediately below that next drop, and then we would be at the lowest point on the ridge connecting Yerapaja and Sula Grande. Another half hour would put us on that col, and it would be easy going from there to the glacier. I perked up. Starting down, I felt at once the change in angle. It was so much easier than the plod along the saddle, and I would have romped happily down the gentle slope, but for the rope tugging insistently at my waist. I had forgotten that Simon would still be wearily following my tracks on the saddle. I had expected to be able to take a direct line to the small rise without encountering any obstacles, and was surprised to find that the slope ended abruptly in an ice cliff. It cut right across my path at right angles, bisecting the ridge. I approached the edge cautiously and peered over a 25-foot drop.
The slope at its base swept down to the right in a smooth, steeply angled face. Beyond that lay the last rise on the ridge, about 200 feet away. The height of the cliff increased rapidly as it cut away from the ridge. I stood roughly midpoint on this wedge of ice running across the ridge, with its narrow edge abutting the ridge line. I traversed carefully away from the ridge, occasionally looking over the cliff to see if there was any weakness in the wall, which stood 35 feet high at its end. I had already discounted the possibility of abseiling past the cliff, for the snow at the top of the cliff was too loose to take an ice stake. There were two options open to me. Either I could stay on the ridge top, or I could continue away from it and hope to bypass the steep section by a wide descending traverse. From where I stood at the end of the cliff, I could see that this would be very tiring and risky. We would have to detour in a wide arc down, across, and then back up again to bypass the cliff. The initial slope down looked very steep and very unstable. I had had enough of slip-sliding around this ridge, and the empty sweep thousands of feet into the eastern glacier bay below the slope nudged me into decision. If either of us fell, we would be on open slopes. We wouldn't stop. At least on the ridge, we had been able to kid ourselves that we could, with luck, jump either side of the apex in the event of a fall. I retraced my steps, intending to climb down the cliff at the easiest point. I knew this would be impossible near the crest of the ridge, since there it was a near-vertical wall of powder snow. I needed to find a weakness in the cliff, a ramp line or a crevasse running down the cliff to give me some purchase on the ice, which appeared solid to within a few yards of the edge of the ridge. At last I saw what I was looking for, a very slight break in the angle of the ice wall. This part of the cliff was still steep, nearly vertical, but not quite. It was about 20 feet high at the break, and I felt sure that at this point a few quick moves of reverse climbing would see me past the problem. Crouching down on my knees, I turned my back to the cliff edge and managed to get my axes to bite in deeply. Slowly I lowered my legs over the cliff until the edge was against my stomach and I could kick my crampons into the ice wall below me. I felt them bite and hold. Removing one axe, I hammered it in again very close to the edge. It held fast and solid. I removed my ice hammer and lowered my chest and shoulders over the edge until I could see the ice wall and swing at it with the hammer. I was hanging onto the ice axe, reaching to my side to place the hammer solidly into the wall with my left hand. I got it to bite after a few blows, but wasn't happy about it and removed it to try again. I wanted it to be perfect before I removed the axe embedded in the lip and lowered myself onto the hammer. As the hammer came out, there was a sharp cracking sound, and my right hand, gripping the axe, pulled down. The sudden jerk turned me outwards, and instantly I was falling. I hit the slope at the base of the cliff before I saw it coming. I was facing into the slope, and both knees locked as I struck it. I felt a shattering blow in my knee, felt bones splitting, and screamed. The impact catapulted me over backwards, and down the slope of the east face, I slid, head first, on my back. The rushing speed of it confused me. I thought of the drop below, but felt nothing. Simon would be ripped off the mountain. He couldn't hold this. I screamed again as I jerked to a sudden, violent stop. Everything was still, silent. My thoughts raced madly. Then pain flooded down my thigh, a fierce burning fire coming down the inside of my thigh, seeming to ball in my groin, building and building until I cried out at it, and my breathing came in ragged gasps. My leg, oh Jesus, my leg! I hung, head down, on my back, left leg tangled in the rope above me, and my right leg hanging slackly to one side. I lifted my head from the snow and stared up across my chest at a grotesque distortion in the right knee, twisting the leg into a strange zigzag. I didn't connect it with the pain which burnt my groin. That had nothing to do with my knee. I kicked my left leg free of the rope and swung round until I was hanging against the snow on my chest, feet down. The pain eased. I kicked my left foot into the slope and stood up. A wave of nausea surged over me. I pressed my face into the snow, and the sharp cold seemed to calm me. Something terrible, something dark with dread, occurred to me, and as I thought about it, I felt the dark thought break into panic. I've broken my leg, that's it. I'm dead. Everyone said it. If there's just two of you, a broken ankle could turn into a death sentence. If it's broken, if... It doesn't hurt so much. Maybe I've just ripped something. I kicked my right leg against the slope, feeling sure it wasn't broken. My knee exploded. Bone grated, and the fireball rushed from groin to knee. I screamed. I looked down at the knee and could see it was broken, yet I tried not to believe what I was seeing.
It wasn't just broken. It was ruptured, twisted, crushed. And I could see the kink in the joint and knew what had happened. The impact had driven my lower leg up through the knee joint. Oddly enough, looking at it seemed to help. I felt detached from it, as if I were making a clinical observation of someone else. I moved the knee gingerly, experimenting with it. I tried to bend it and stopped immediately, gasping at the rush of pain. When it moved, I felt a grinding crunch. Bone had moved, and a lot more besides. At least it wasn't an open fracture. I knew this as soon as I tried to move. I could feel no wetness, no blood. I reached down and caressed the knee with my right hand, trying to ignore the stabs of fire so that I could feel it with enough force to be certain I wasn't bleeding. It was in one solid piece, but it felt huge and twisted, and not mine. The pain kept flooding round it, pouring on fire, as if that might cure it, then and there. With a groan, I squeezed my eyes tight shut. Hot tears filled my eyes and my contact lenses swam in them. I squeezed tight again and felt hot drops rolling over my face. It wasn't the pain. I felt sorry for myself, childishly so. And with that thought, I couldn't help the tears. Dying had seemed so far away, and yet now everything was tinged with it. I shook my head to stop the tears, but the taint was still there. I dug my axes into the snow and pounded my good leg deeply into the soft slope until I felt sure it wouldn't slip. The effort brought back the nausea, and I felt my head spin giddily to the point of fainting. I moved, and a searing spasm of pain cleared away the faintness. I could see the summit of Surya Norte away to the west. I was not far below it. The sight drove home how desperately things had changed. We were above 19,000 feet, still on the ridge, and very much alone. I looked south at the small rise I had hoped to scale quickly, and it seemed to grow with every second that I stared. I would never get over it. Simon would not be able to get me up it. He would leave me. He had no choice. I held my breath, thinking about it. Left here. Alone. I felt cold at the thought. I remembered Rob, who had been left to die. But Rob had been unconscious, had been dying. I had only a bad leg. Nothing to kill me. For an age, I felt overwhelmed at the notion of being left. I felt like screaming, and I felt like swearing, but stayed silent. If I said a word, I would panic. I could feel myself teetering on the edge of it. The rope, which had been tight on my harness, went slack. Simon was coming. He must know something had happened, I thought, but what shall I tell him? If I told him that I had only hurt my leg and not broken it, would that make him help me? My mind raced at the prospect of telling him that I was hurt. I pressed my face into the cold snow again and tried to think calmly. I had to cool it. If he saw me panicky and hysterical, he might give up at once. I fought to stem my fears. Be rational about it, I thought. I felt myself calm down, and my breathing became steady. Even the pain seemed tolerable.
What happened? You okay?
I looked up in surprise. I hadn't heard his approach. He stood at the top of the cliff, looking down at me, puzzled. I made an effort to talk normally, as if nothing had happened.
I fell. The edge gave way.
I paused. Then I said as unemotionally as I could, I've broken my leg. His expression changed instantly. I could see a whole range of reactions in his face. I kept looking directly at him. I wanted to miss nothing.
Are you sure it's broken?
Yes. He stared at me. It seemed that he looked harder and longer than he should have done because he turned away sharply. Not sharply enough, though. I had seen the look come across his face briefly, but in that instant I knew his thoughts. He had an odd air of detachment. I felt unnerved by it, felt suddenly quite different from him, alienated. His eyes had been full of thoughts. Pity. Pity and something else. A distance given to a wounded animal which could not be helped. He had tried to hide it, but I had seen in, and I looked away full of dread and worry.
I'll abseil down to you.
He had his back to me, bending over a snowstake, digging down through the soft snow. He sounded matter-of-fact, and I wondered whether I was being unduly paranoid. I waited for him to say more, but he remained silent, and I wondered what he was thinking. A short but very dangerous abseil from a poorly anchored snowstake put him down next to me quickly. He stood close by me and said nothing. I had seen him glance at my leg, but he made no comment. After some searching, he found a packet of paracetamols and handed me two pills. I swallowed them, and watched him trying to pull the abseil rope down. It refused.